November 18th, 2003. It's the largest troop rotation since World War II. On November 6th, the Pentagon announced that the Army next year will undertake its largest series of troop rotations since World War II, when it sends 85,000 new Army and Marine combat forces to Iraq to replace soldiers ending one-year tours. Also, they've put on alert an additional 43,000 National Guard and Reserve support troops, actually troops in the front line, not really support, that they will also send to Iraq as well. In addition, they've announced that for a period beginning 90 days before their departure to 90 days after their return, they will not allow anyone in the military to either resign or leave after their tour of duty. This is the stop loss. Assassins Are Us, Vietnam Meets Iraq, our Taking Aim program for today. Ralph?
Maya, the United Press International report on the 14th of November has the headline, U.S. Casualties from Iraq War Top 9,000. Now, that headline is in conflict, of course, with the official fiction that the numbers of casualties are approximately 1,700. And it amplifies what we had broadcast last week about how 7,000 casualties alone had been brought to the Ramstein Hospital in Germany, indicating that the U.S. authorities have enormously suppressed the scale of casualty, killed, wounded, evacuated from this occupation in Iraq. And the article by Mark Benjamin in United Press International reads, the number of U.S. casualties from Operation Iraqi Freedom, killed, wounded, and evacuated due to injury, has now passed 9,000. And it states the total number of casualties is over 9,200, and an increase of nearly 3,000 since the first week of October. We are shocked at the dramatic increase in casualties, which seems to be without limits, stated Steve Robinson, executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center.
Now, Ralph, these casualties have not been lost upon the military themselves. The U.S. military looks increasingly like a temp agency on steroids, a massive organization of part-time workers armed with the latest in firepower. This is the quote from the provost, that's the administrator concerned with educational matters, at the University of California at Santa Cruz, Con Hallinan, who writes regularly for the San Francisco Chronicle. A temp agency on steroids. Since September 11th, he notes, some 292,000 National Guard and Reserve troops have been called to active duty, and more than 190,000 are still serving. Now, with this new call-up, the Reserve and National Guard units make up 46% of the military. 46%. From World War I to the Gulf War, which is 75 years, the reserves were called up nine times. They were called up nine times. But in the last 12 years alone, they've been mobilized 10 times. In 75 years, nine times. In the last 12 years, 10 times. This is the permanent war. But it's a real transformation that's going on in the military. Their deployments have stretched to 12 and sometimes 15 months. And as Ralph has noted, the injury levels are up to 7,000, and they are being killed.
Well, that's 7,000 just at Ramstein Hospital. One hospital in Germany, Maya. 7,000, and the UPI figure is 9,200, but we know it is multiples higher than that, because if one hospital registers 7,000 and that's precisely documented, we can only begin to imagine what the real casualty rate is.
Weekend warrior my ass, says one of the reservists. echoing the sentiment of them all. When you look at this transformation of the military, you see that essentially the financial burden for maintaining the permanent troops for the permanent war has fallen to the family of the reserves. Ralph.
Maya, the hidden cost of Bush's war is the headline in the London Independent on November 14th. Concern about fatalities among Western forces in Iraq overlooks another ghastly statistic, the spectacularly mounting toll of the severely wounded. Andrew Buncombe reports on America's invisible army of the maimed and the crippled, and he details the hidden cost of Bush's war. Sergeant Mike Menem lost his leg in Iraq and just 2 weeks since received a new one, still getting used to the prosthetic. I can't be upset, he says. We went to Iraq for a reason. But Sergeant Minum is among the thousands of wounded soldiers who returned from Iraq to uncertain futures, months and years of difficult and painful treatment, an American public wholly unaware that so many troops are being injured every day. The reality is this. Iraqi hospitals had struggled to deal with their huge numbers of wounded civilians during the invasion of the country, and now military hospitals in the U.S. are overflowing with wounded Americans. And it states, while the Bush administration has attempted to conceal the huge number of severely wounded soldiers whose injuries and fate go unreported, the hospitals can no longer contain the reality. And this detailed article particularizes the horrendous nature of these specific injuries, which have shredded limbs and have resulted in a 20% rate of severe brain injuries. 70% are head wounds with resulting brain injury. And the fifth floor of Walter Reed, where soldier after soldier finds themselves, have reported on a bulletin board patient photographs crammed full of pictures of young men. We didn't start the board when the war began. Even the most experienced people here state it's beyond their imagining. This is on a scale that we have never seen before. It gives an indication of the magnitude of the resistance in Iraq and the effects on the U.S. soldiers as a consequence.
But what has most annoyed, annoy is really a very light word for it, the soldiers and their family, is that Bush has ignored the wounded and the dead. It took Cher, the popular entertainer, and a visit that she gave to made to Walter Reed Hospital and an anonymous phone call to an online radio station to point out all the amputated soldiers that she had seen. And she asked, why isn't Dick Rumsfeld here? Dick Cheney here? Why isn't Donald Rumsfeld here? Where is President Bush? Why have they ignored all the injured? But most of all, Bush has ignored the soldiers' burials. The Pentagon has told reporters that they are not to photograph any of the coffins. And as was noted by Christopher Scheer on October 30th in Alternate, Bush ignores soldiers' burials. Three more U.S. servicemen were killed in combat in Iraq. In the coming days, their bodies will be boxed up and sent home for burial. While en route, the coffins will be deliberately shielded from view, lest the media capture on film the dark image. Hundreds of U.S. troops killed in the war to date, the dead soldiers interred and memorialized without the solemn presence of the President of the United States.
Well, Maya, the cover-up is extraordinary, and many of the papers now are only beginning to catch up with it. The Toronto Star, the Pentagon keeps the dead out of sight. The Bush team doesn't want people to see the enormous human cost of this war. The body bags are sanitized as transfer tubes. They are brought into the Air Force Base in Dover, Delaware. The military collects these aluminum shipping cases and takes them across a tarmac with guards, armed guards, to prevent journalists or family members or civilians from noticing the magnitude of the a number of those who are being brought in. America never saw Lieutenant Colonel Buring's arrival after a rocket from a homemade launcher ended his life at age 40. Americans have never seen the hundreds of bodies returning from Iraq to this one air base. They do not see the wounded cramming the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. They do not see the soldiers who are being treated inhumanely as they await medical treatment at Fort Stewart, Georgia, on stretchers without medication, paying for their own bandages, asked to pay for their own meals. No television cameras are allowed. The grieving families, the flag-draped coffins, the soldiers have lost their limbs. Bush does not attend the funerals of soldiers who gave their lives in his so-called war on terrorism, the Toronto Star reports. And indeed, no government official has said a word publicly about this scale of amputees and dead and wounded. No government officials speak of the thousands of wounded soldiers, of the Americans who are brought into hospitals suffering from neurological damage that is not only the result of weaponry from the Iraqi resistance, but reflects as well the vaccination programs and the depleted uranium that is affecting the Iraqi population as well.
It is a steady drizzle of death. Steady drizzle of death is what Ron Fournier from the Associated Press on November 13th called the deaths taking place and the effect it's having on Bush's popularity in the heartland. He notes that at that time, more than 390 soldiers from 47 states and the District of Columbia, as well as the two territories, have died in Iraq since the war began on March 20th. It's every state but Hawaii, Montana, and West Virginia. Now, if you look at the steady drizzle of death, you have the face of death, Army Private Timothy R. Brown of Conway, Pennsylvania, killed in August when his armored personnel vehicle hit a roadside bomb near Tikrit. Army Sergeant Ernest Buklu of Darlington Township, Pennsylvania, killed when an Army helicopter was shot down near Baghdad, and he was en route to his mother's funeral, so his father had to bury two of the closest people in his family. Brian Slavinus of Illinois was also killed with Sergeant Ernest Buklu. If you look at small towns across the United States and also major cities, you find the steady drizzle of death, whether it's Mira Mesa, California, Detroit, Michigan, New York City, San Francisco, California. Everywhere you look throughout the country, you find people wounded, maimed, and dead.
And Maya, in The Age, on November 17th, amputee soldiers ponder the bittersweet price of survival every hour of every day for months. The wounded, the amputees, are being brought to U.S. hospitals. The I think I should be dead specialist, DaCosta 20, said recently at the Walter Reed Army Medical Hospital. Reminded that his life had been saved, he reflected on the fact that he would not walk again. And indeed, the Pentagon limits funeral coverage, reports the Washington Post. Arlington to keep reporters away, Steve Vogel on November 14th. The Army has tightened control on press coverage of funerals at Arlington National Cemetery, directing that reporters be kept far enough away from the gravesides that they could not even hear a chaplain's eulogy. And Ron Paul, the Republican from Texas, the mistreatment of our soldiers and our veterans. Speaking of the conditions at Fort Stewart, Georgia, where hundreds of injured reserve and National Guards are housed in deplorable conditions and forced to wait months just to see a doctor. These soldiers, he writes, who made huge sacrifices leaving their families and their jobs, find themselves living in hot, crowded, unsanitary barracks, waiting for hours and days and weeks to see overworked doctors. Hardly the heroes welcome. These men and women are expressing shock at their treatment. They assumed that wounded soldiers returning from Iraq would receive priority, given the support the troops' rhetoric coming from Washington. Their complaints go ignored, and the media are being careful not to report it. The wounded soldiers convalescing are forced to pay for hospital meals from their own pockets at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. Soldiers returning stateside have to buy their own airfare home. They have to pay for their own desert boots, their night vision goggles, and other military necessities out of personal and family funds. Paul writes, "It is shocking. Our troops are being forced to pay for basic items that are supposed to be supplied to them from the military budget. The billions, the hundreds of billions of dollars that go to sustain contracts in Iraq are not sufficient to provide for the elementary needs of the troops when they are wounded."
Ralph, what Representative Paul is referring to is until recently, and as a result of the outcry, there's been a change in Congress, military personnel were supposed to pay $8.10 a day for their food when they were hospitalized in military hospitals. This has been going on for years, and it only changed as a result of the outcry during the attack on Iraq. Now, also a professor at George Washington Law School, Professor Turley, in reaction to what happened to one of his law students, wrote an incredible article that appeared in the Dodge City Daily Globe and can be seen online at their website. "Flak jackets are slim comfort for troops in Iraq." He writes, "It appears that parents across the country are now purchasers of body armor because of the failure of the military to supply soldiers with modern vests. Suzanne Werfelman is a mother and a teacher, and she has been shopping for individual body armor." And this is not a response, he says, to threats from her elementary school students in Scotia, Pennsylvania. "It's a desperate attempt to protect her son, Army Specialist Richard Murphy. He's a military policeman in Iraq, and he was also one of Professor Turley's law students before he was sent off for a 20-month stint. Now, he was assigned, that is, Army Specialist Richard Murphy, was assigned an old Vietnam War-era vest rather than the modern interceptor vest, which has Kevlar pockets in front and back with ceramic plates that protect vital organs and is able to stop machine gun bullets, shrapnel, and other ordnance. Now, what's happened is that General Richard B. Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the other members of the Pentagon had decided that to save money, they would change from the old Vietnam-era jackets over a 10-year period, doing a one-for-one exchange of new-for-old vests. The vests cost, the ceramic plates cost about $650. As a result, many of the soldiers being sent into Iraq do not have the new modern vests, and their parents, as they say, instead of sending them packages of cookies and breads, are sending them the vests. This is also true of night vision goggles. So while the billions and billions of the war appropriations go to Lockheed, go to Boeing, go to Northrop Grumman, meanwhile, the soldiers on the ground, particularly the reservists, the temp employees, the precarious workers, those without any protections, and in fact no one in the military has any protections or even the right of free speech, they are dependent upon their parents to be protecting them from injury.
Let's look at the consequences in the minds and hearts of the military and the families of the military in base across base at Fort Bragg to Fort Stewart, the very locations where Bush goes for his photo ops. "Doubt when duty calls," reports the St. Petersburg Times on November 17th. "His mother mailed disposable cameras to him in Iraq and told him to snap pictures of everything. She couldn't have imagined this. Bomb blasts, victims of that blast, bandages around stumps and tattered flesh. And here's the response of her son. I'm not going out on that road again. I won't do it. It's crazy." And he states, "Many of us have come to the same conclusion. We're coming home, and we realize we're not going to go back to this. I was wondering if we were ever going to get home safe. I leaned back and looked over and saw the remains of my buddy next to me, blasts, blood running, deafened from the blast. I could hear a sergeant talking, and then I realized the worst. And he states, "At one point, I said I would do what I'm told. I now have realized that I will not. If I'm ordered to resume duty on this truck, I will refuse. And if there are any types of consequences for it, I'll take them. I'll still be living, and I'll still have my health. And most of us feel the same way. I'm not going to give them another chance to kill me. It's lucky I lived through this. This was a sign. I'm not risking my life again for these people." And that theme is echoed in the report in the New York Times on November 17th. Families already rattled, kept on edge by news of the crash of the Black Hawk helicopters. "My heart sinks when I hear about what's happening to our boys. We pray that it isn't one more of them. 9 families here in the strip of towns along the Kentucky-Tennessee border learned on Sunday that it had been theirs who were downed. Families are expected to get similar grim news as the drizzly evenings wore on." And the report details how at Fort Campbell, and at places like Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and Clarksville, Tennessee, where the poor, where white working-class poor and black and Hispanic poor are shunted off to die and to be wounded and maimed and come back to a neglect and an absence of treatment, the theme is clear and it's echoed by all of them. No more of this. We'll never go back to this again. And
Ralph, bring them home now is the call. And Bring Them Home Now is a new organization that started in August after President George W. Bush came on with his statement to the Iraqi resistance, "Bring them on, bring them on." Well, the parents of the military families and their wives and their aunts, their uncles and their children said, "Bring them home now," to Bush's statement of "bring them on." And they started this incredible organization, and it's particularly supportive in areas where there are active military bases. In San Antonio, Texas, for instance, on November 8th, they had a large demonstration where there are 4 active military bases in San Antonio. And they had a press conference with parents and aunts and wives of people in Iraq.
And Maya, the Associated Press reported expansively, "Military families speak out against the Iraq war at large gathering in Texas. Families, husbands, sons, and other relatives serving in Iraq gathered in mass in drizzling weather Saturday in this military-dependent city to voice their opposition to this war and the way in which the U.S.-led war is being handled. This is how I show my support for our soldiers," said Candace Robson, whose husband, Army First Lieutenant Mike Robeson, is serving with the 82nd Airborne in Fallujah, the heart of the anti-American insurgency. "If my husband gets killed and I haven't done everything I can to bring him home, I'd never forgive myself." And family member after family member speaks in the same way. The same people who Bush saw as his base of support at the bases are disaffected and mobilizing in opposition. Again, the Associated Press from Fort Stewart, Georgia. "The sick, the injured, the reservists rip Army care." And it details the anger of the families and of the citizen soldiers who are responding to their abuse and to their neglect.
What the statement of Bring Them Home Now says explicitly is the American public was deceived by the Bush administration about the motivation for and the intent for the invasion of Iraq. These military actions are not perceived as liberations, but as occupations. Bring them home now. Not one more troop killed in action. Not one more troop wounded in action. Not one more troop psychologically damaged by the act of terrifying, humiliating, injuring or killing innocent people. Not one more troop spending one more day inhaling depleted uranium. Not one more troop separated from spouse and children. This is the only way to truly support these troops and the families who are just as much a part of the military as they are. And also, taking a very bold stand, a very brave stand, you have Army Reservist Frank Mendez, who along with 25 of his family members, friends, and members of Veterans for Peace, stood out Friday, October 3rd, outside the Newark offices of New Jersey Senators Corzine and Lautenberg. It was Mendez's 23rd birthday, and he was home on a 13-day leave from the 310 Battalion deployed in Iraq. It was a bold statement from Mendez. He said he knew what he was doing, and he knows we shouldn't be there. Bring the troops home. It's a bold statement because soldiers who have expressed their opposition to the war and have talked about the troops being brought home have been court-martialed and have been censored by the military.
And for all that, Maya, the press now is beginning to register the scale of opposition. Here's the Ivy Press report by Rita Chang on the 16th of November. The ever-spreading and increasing disenchantment among military personnel and veterans with the Bush administration's handling of the American occupation in Iraq is creating a liability for President Bush in his 2004 re-election bid, said journalists at a briefing yesterday. Defining military voters as U.S. military personnel, veterans, and voters with friends and families in the U.S. military, Ben Wallace Wells, editor of the Washington Monthly, told this audience, predominantly Republicans, that there's a new breed of voters in the next presidential election, voters in Bush country. Fayetteville, Beaufort, Jacksonville, small conservative coastal towns of North Carolina, profound discontent, opposition, resistance. Since 6 months ago, you simply didn't hear anything against Bush in Jacksonville. These attitudes have changed across the board. The local newspaper's editorial board, vocally pro-Bush, has run editorials criticizing the policies on Iraq and declaring that this is a Vietnam-like quagmire punctuated by the abuse of the soldiers who have been sent out and using the language of cannon fodder. And Vets for Common Sense reports Senator Bond. Senator Bond demanding an investigation into Fort Knox and Fort Stewart scandals, the United Press International reports. Over 600 soldiers waiting for weeks and months for a doctor at Fort Stewart in squalid cement barracks, no air conditioning, no running water. UPI reports that over 400 wounded soldiers await long waits for care at Fort Knox, Tennessee. Senator Bond, acting Secretary of the Army, Brownlee has said to me, well, we'll do something about this. He went there, I guess, a week ago, and before he had left, we had made clear to him that the minimum standards for soldiers, housing, health, doctor attention, bandages, minimal care, has been denied them. Fort Stewart, Fort Knox, Fort Campbell, Fort Bragg, all of it, says Senator Bond, it has to stop. And Senator Hollins, Ernest Hollins, who voted for the war and supported the war, has now published a statement called The Truth About Iraq, in which he has put on record the Pentagon and the military and the Bush administration's total abuse, total neglect, total betrayal of these young soldiers, the cannon fodder for imperial war. And indeed, reported in the Washington Post by Tom Ricks on November 16th, the U.S. tolerance of death is being tested. The key variable in the public tolerance of U.S. military deaths in combat is whether the people believe in the appropriateness of the policy. The report concludes that President Bush has lost most of his supporters over his handling of Iraq and the treatment of soldiers on their return.
They would lose more if people were able to see the images from Iraq, but the U.S. military stops the U.S. journalists from covering the story. Meanwhile, the European and the journalists from the Middle East are able to cover it. And then we have the self-censorship of the newspapers. On November 7th, war declared on resistance. This was an article that appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia. But what they're noting about the war on resistance is the word resistance. The Los Angeles Times has ordered its journalists to stop describing the anti-American forces in Iraq as resistance fighters, saying the term romanticizes them and evokes World War II heroism. An email was circulated that asked the staff instead to use the term insurgents or guerrillas. This is the Los Angeles Times.
And this gives rise to the remarkable statement and article in the New York Times on the 16th of November, the Sunday edition of the New York Times, by Max Boot, The Lessons of a Quagmire. Max Boot is a senior member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he makes the analysis of the war in Iraq in comparison with that in Vietnam.
We will return to Max Boot, but first, this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet, www.wbai.org. Our program today, Assassins Are Us, Vietnam Meets Iraq.
Max Boot writes, "The biggest error the armed forces made in Vietnam was fighting the guerrilla war the same way they had fought the Wehrmacht. The military was staging huge, big unit sweeps with fancy code names like Cedar Falls and Junction City and dropped more bombs than they had during the entirety of World War II over the agricultural country of Vietnam. What proved, however, effective for us in Vietnam were not these large conventional operations, but our targeted counterinsurgency programs known as CAP, CORDS, Kit Carson Scouts, and Phoenix. These were what were effective. CAP stood for Combined Action Platoons. Under it, we secured the villages, and the coordination of the military skills and the operations of our Kit Carson Scouts and Phoenix programs did the rest. CORDS, or Civil Operations and Rural Development Support, was the counterinsurgency run by two CIA legends, Robert Comer and William Colby. It oversaw programs to win the hearts and minds of South Vietnamese villagers. And we have to apply this in Iraq," writes Max Boot. "The Kit Carson Scouts, they were fiercely loyal. They involved themselves in the torture with electricity of recalcitrant cadre of the Viet Cong. The Phoenix program was a joint CIA-South Vietnam effort to identify and eradicate cadre in villages. Critics have charged the program with carrying out six assassinations, and William Colby acknowledged this. Nevertheless, apart from those who were killed, we captured 33,000 and induced to defect another 22,000. Apart from the 60,000 who were killed, there is little doubt that if we place more emphasis on these programs, we will fare better. We will fare better. To ensure the Sunni triangle, the army must focus on classic counterinsurgency techniques." And he advocates and he promotes the counterinsurgency programs of assassination, of the Kit Carson torture brigades, of the Navy SEALs who rung them up with electrodes on genitalia and on eyes, the severing of ears, the severing of noses, the severing of lips, the mutilation of bodies, the torture process, which was the feature of the war crime of U.S. presence in Vietnam, now advocated openly on the pages of the New York Times for Iraq.
And if you look at Newsweek, with the Ghost Squad, an article by Christian Carlisle, an amazing article in its description of the similarities between Iraq and Vietnam. In this article, he describes what happens on a typical patrol. Polston, referring to one of the soldiers by the name of Polston from the first Infantry Division is running a house-to-house search. Intelligence reports say there are Ba'ath loyalists in the village, according to Newsweek, organizing anti-U.S. attacks. Poston is standing by when the Americans knock on one locked front door. Through a crack in the side of an unfinished house, he sees a bearded man inside holding an AK-7, or so he says. He then fires a three-round burst into the room and his automatic weapon, and the man falls. The man's wife and two small children are screaming. "I shot him," says Poston. "He had a weapon." Medics are easing the wounded Iraqi onto a stretcher. "This is the fifth guy I've shot," says Poston. "This is the fifth guy I've shot." In other words, he knocks on the door, he opens the door, and then he shoots whoever appears.
Assassins Are Us. The title of this show is also the headline of the article by Chalmers Johnson. Assassins Are Us, November 17th. Assassinations, extermination squads, massive reprisals against civilians. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has ordered a change in policy to shift the major emphasis to assassination squads, the new special operations organization, according to reporters Tom Shanker and Eric Schmidt, designed to act with speed, high-value targets, isolating villages, drawing on the experience of U.S. Army Special Forces and Death Squad troops who run down their quarry and answer no questions without debate. Without oversight, we are adopting a militarized version of Terminator squads wherever we want, wherever we care to, whose operations will be directed and whose actions will be with impunity.
Ralph, but aside from the specific Force 121 and other special forces, when I speak of Jeremy Poston, who's 28 years old, I'm talking about your normal Army grunt, Specialist 4. Or when you speak of Patrick McDonald, another Specialist 4 with Bravo Company, the 3rd Squad, 1st Platoon. McDonald was at the helm of an AT-4 anti-tank weapon, a rocket designed to spray shrapnel over a, quote, kill radius of 35 yards on impact. And he uses his AT-4. According to Newsweek, the smell of cordite mixes with the dank breeze from the river. After 15 minutes, the sentry post calls to say the so-called attackers have fled. The squad is pumped up. They've won. Then Specialist 4 Robinson Jean, 23 years old, fondles his Lucy, his M240 machine gun. "Ghost Squad took care of it, man," he crows. "You gotta love it. Especially being a citizen soldier." On and on. These soldiers, what has happened to them is that they revel. They revel in the mayhem, the injuries, and the deaths of those they are attacking, of those they are occupying, or those they are serving, the ruling class, the masters.
Maya, the Chalmers Johnson Assassinations Are Us continues. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has taken a leaf explicitly from the playbook of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who has long employed hit squads against Palestinians who displease him. And indeed, it details the process of Operation Ivy Cyclone, using F-16 bombers to drop 500-pound bombs on villages in all the surrounding areas of Tikrit and Fallujah, followed immediately by Operation Iron Hammer within Baghdad itself. Armored vehicles blowing up houses and civilian properties with families inside, targeting anyone who is suspected of support or sympathy or apathy in the path of the resistance. Quote, "Staying the course in Iraq means our Iraqi version of the Vietnam staple, the saturation bombing of cities, the herding of civilians into barbed wire enclosed strategic hamlets, a rerun of the Phoenix program in which the CIA and special forces assassinated 60,000 people. Los Angeles Times, Iraqi special forces are ready. And indeed, the operations that are being described in assassinations are us are detailed once again in the Los Angeles Times.
Ralph, when you're talking about Israel, the new campaign, the one where they were using the F-16s and the massive firepower, was called Operation Iron Hammer. Also, that's the new one before they had the cyclone one. Operation Iron Hammer. Sound familiar with the metaphor of iron that the Israelis use for all their campaigns? And then an article in The Independent on the 18th of November, Americans Turn to Crete into Iraq's Own West Bank, by Phil Reeves. Quote, it is the West Bank and Gaza Strip, but transported to Iraq. A town is imprisoned by razor wire. The entrance is guarded by soldiers, protected by sandbags, concrete barricades, and a machine gun nest. Only those people with an identification card issued by the occupation authorities are allowed in, or more importantly, out. Hey, this is just like Gaza, isn't it? A fiery young Iraqi policeman shouted at us from behind the chest-high three-layer wire coils which separate his home from the rest of the surrounding dead-flat Iraqi landscape, Sunni Triangle Heartland. We're not happy. Not happy. This is Aija, the wealthy enclave outside Tikrit. It has long been a center of pro-Saddam anti-American sentiments, according to The Independent. Now, we have here a town surrounded by barbed wire, everyone given identification cards, cut off from the rest of society. And again, shoot to kill. Shoot to kill is the policy in Iraq. And a U.S. patrol opened fire this week on Monday on a group of people who were in the marketplace. This was Baghdad's gun market. They killed three people when the customers were testing weapons. Now, in Iraq, it is legal for a family to own an AK-47 assault rifle, and this is for their self-defense. So that when the soldiers open up a door and someone is holding a rifle because they think there might be a bandit coming, the soldiers shoot to kill. And even in the marketplace, the soldiers shoot to kill.
And Maya, Kenneth Armitage stated, we have a very solid plan. We're going to go and get these people. We're going to take this fight to the enemy in their towns, in their villages, everywhere. And Republican Senator Trent Lott amplified this. We are going to mow the whole place down. See what happens. We're dealing with insane people who kill our people. We're going to be very aggressive. We're going to take them all out. Quote, unquote, Senator Trent Lott, the 11th of November, 2003. And then, indeed, the World News reports on the 16th of November, Iraqi farmers say U.S. troops threaten to destroy their homes and villages, surveying the bombs on their fields. Iraqi farmers said in Abu Ghraib on Friday that American troops have threatened to eliminate their villages unless they provide information on guerrillas. Farmers told Reuters that U.S. soldiers are mounting a crackdown that involves wiping out villages, wiping out houses, destroying and killing those who are inside. Nearby farmers say they are paying the price for a conflict that shows no signs of abating. Every night it used to be, but now we have it more than once a night. They are attacking us without discrimination. They point to craters in the fields. They point to houses leveled. They point to crops destroyed and burnt. They point to a scorched earth policy.
Erich Marquardt for the Power and Interest News Report wrote, the U.S. occupation of Iraq is entering a critical phase, and he calls it the policy of Iraqification. Iraqification involves training the Iraqi military, the security forces, to have them replace U.S. forces. Not replace U.S. forces, according to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, but to supplement them. The idea is to have the Iraqis torture the Iraqis themselves. And he notes also, speaking about our Abu Ghraib, that New York Times reporter Alex Berenson reported that U.S. troops, quote, fired on a photographer trying to cover the fighting and barred reporters from viewing the scene. So the idea is, just like the Israelis, don't let anyone see. Put everything behind closed doors. Don't let the American public know what is taking place. While the U.S. forces lock down cities, conduct house to house, and torture people, maim them, and then develop an Iraqi troop which can do the same. Iraqification, Vietnam is here. Ralph.
Appeals to U.S. soldiers. But before we deal with the appeals to U.S. soldiers, let's talk for a moment about the reports in the Toledo, Ohio Blade, a series of five reports on the Tiger Brigade, the Tiger Force. Sam Ibarra sat in the darkness of his mother's Arizona home sobbing. Once a feared member of Tiger Force who boasted of shooting civilians, he is now a broken figure, haunted by images of the war. I would ask him, "What's wrong? Why are you crying?" He would say, "It's my life. What I did. I killed people. Regular people, Mama. My God. What did I do?" His hands shaking, he would curl up on her couch, repeating the question, "Why? Why?" The once stocky paratrooper was a notorious figure in the longest war crime investigation of the Vietnam War. He would sit and cry, "I feel bad, I ask God to forgive me for what I did." And the emergence of the evidence about this over and over again. He was seen cutting off the ears of dead enemy soldiers at villages, scalping them with hunting knives. They were struck by the same image. 13 former platoon members acknowledged Ibarra was wearing necklaces of human ears. By the time an investigation was underway, he was discharged and living in Arizona, where he was raised. After years of alcohol and drugs, he died of pneumonia at 36. Green was accused by fellow platoon officers of torturing gag prisoners, repeatedly jabbing knives into necks before killing them by slashing their throats.
Ralph Green was the friend of the Ibarra, who was also in the platoon.
And indeed, he was Boots Green, Sam Ibarra's friend, as you rightly state, Maya, was but one of the many who were engaged in this systematic mutilation and slaughter of random people in village after village. They bragged about raping and killing a teenage girl after a search and destroy mission near Tam Kỳ in August.
Ralph, it was a 4.5-year investigation that was never made public before the Toledo Blade did its report. And this 4.5-year investigation substantiated 20 war crimes by 18 soldiers, and it had reached both the Pentagon and the White House before the investigation was closed in 1975. Now, this happened before Milai, which is the massacre that that drew public attention, and it was substantiated that this was not an exception in Vietnam, not an exception, but not made known to the U.S. public.
Well, Maya, Nick Terse, who is a graduate student at Columbia, who's doing his doctorate on the war in Vietnam, has written a piece called "The Tip of the Iceberg: The Report on the Vietnam Tiger Force Atrocities, But the Tip of the Iceberg," the October 19, 2003 Toledo Blade, 4-day series of investigative reportings exposing a string of atrocities by elite Tiger Force units of the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division over a course of 7 months. Indeed, the report describes the torture of prisoners, the rape of civilian women, the mutilation of bodies, the killing of over 100 armed civilians at one time. But the article by Nick Terse states there were thousands of analogous events across Vietnam. As a historian, writing my dissertation on U.S. war crimes and atrocities during the Vietnam War, I have documented not hundreds but thousands of analogous events. I can sadly but safely say the Tiger Force atrocities are but the tip of the iceberg with respect to U.S. perpetrated war crimes in Vietnam. How much of the mainstream historical literature dealing with the Vietnam War atrocities and accompanying cover-ups and sham investigations has been marginalized and suppressed, and he isolates and exposes a series of My Lai-like events, and he describes in particular the Navy SEAL operation of Bob Carey's units in the hamlet of Tan Phong, the massacre at Son Tong, referred to as the Marine Corps' My Lai, the war crimes reported by Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Herbert and famously chronicled in his memoir, Soldier, operations of the Kit Carson scouts that we've described before, including the 172nd with its personnel Norman Bowers, Francis Pichick, and Eberhard Gasper on active duty, engaged in mutilation, sustained slaughter of civilians, rape and killing, cutting of throats.
Well, Ralph, these are the very investigations that you initiated with the tribunal, the War Crimes Tribunal.
Indeed, Maya, with respect to the International War Crimes Tribunal on Indochina, the scorched earth free fire zone policy encompassed all of South Vietnam in every village, in every location where the National Liberation Front had any basis of support, which was throughout the country. Every single civilian villager was targeted by these special forces. It was a daily event. The massacres of My Lai and the massacres of Tiger Force are only surfaced when a sector of the class wishes to embarrass the authorities with respect to an operation that they consider to be recklessly endangering their class interests. But the documentation, just to mention the book by Clergy and Laymen Concerned, in the Name of America, which cited the daily dispatches from reporters in the field that never saw the light of day. It was a daily event in Vietnam, and it is going to become so in Iraq.
Hold on to your humanity is an open letter to GIs in Iraq from Stan Goff, a retired veteran who had been a ranger in Vietnam. He writes, "My own son is among you, a paratrooper like I was. When I started hearing about he states specifically, they chumped us about Vietnam. Anyone can be chumped. We had to dehumanize our victims before we did the things we did. We knew deep down that what we were doing was wrong. So they became dinks or gooks, just like Iraqis are now being transformed into ragheads
or
hajis. Something inside us told us that so long as they were human beings with the same intrinsic value we had as human beings, we were not allowed to burn their homes and barns, kill their animals, and sometimes kill them." He said, "I live with rage every day of my life, even when no one else sees it. You might hear it in my words. I hate being chumped. The big bosses are trying to gain control of the world's energy supplies to twist the arms of future economic competitors. That's what's going on, and you need to understand it. Then do what you need to do to hold on to your humanity. The system does that, tells you that you are some kind of hero action figures, but uses you as gunmen. They chump you. They don't care, so you have to." He said, "It's perfectly legal for you to refuse illegal orders, and orders to abuse or attack civilians are illegal. Ordering you to keep silent about these crimes is also illegal." And this is from Stan Goff, a member of Bring the Troops Home. Ralph.
Maya, on May 24th, 1966, Bertrand Russell and I collaborated on an appeal to American soldiers. It was broadcast on the National Liberation Front radio to American soldiers. This is Bertrand Russell speaking to you on the radio of the forces of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam. I speak to you, American soldiers, to explain how your government has abused your rights in sending you to occupy a country whose people are united in their hatred of the United States government as a foreign aggressor. It is not difficult to understand why it is that the Vietnamese people hate the United States government. The people of Vietnam have been fighting for 25 years to secure their independence. They fought against the Japanese, who were cruel, and later against the French, who set up guillotines in villages throughout Vietnam and beheaded those suspected of being opposed to foreign occupation. Not many of you know that the United States government financed 80% of the French war and supplied France with all modern weapons to assist the evil task of subjugating, killing the people of Vietnam. Your Air Force is flying 650 sorties a week, and the tonnages used in the South are higher than those used during the Second World War. You are using napalm, which burns everything it touches. You are using phosphorus, which eats like an acid into those who are in its path. You are using fragmentation bombs and lazy dogs, which cut up into pieces and lacerate women and children in the villages hit without discrimination. You are using poison chemicals, which cause blindness and affect the nervous system and paralyze the victims, even as these effects will be felt by you. You are using poison gases which are listed in Army manuals of World War II as poisons, and gases so deadly that soldiers with gas masks have been killed by their own gas. When you return from battle, ask yourselves, who are these people you are killing? How many women and children have died at your hands today? What would you feel if these things were happening in the United States to your wives and your parents and your children? How can you bear the thought of what is taking place around you day after day? Week after week, I ask these questions of you because you bear responsibility, and within your hands lies the choice of whether this criminal war is to continue. And Bertrand Russell said in this statement, "You are being asked to enrich the few industrialists whose profits depend on taking the natural resources from other countries. And this is while people throughout the world are rising against this brutal war. You know that there is an outlawing of gas and chemicals and torture and mutilation. You know that special forces are trained in techniques used at Auschwitz and in concentration camps." And Bertrand Russell says, "You must not think that you are alone. For throughout the United States, people oppose this war. Hundreds of thousands of people have met in New York City alone, and tens of thousands across cities in the United States and in other countries. Have you been present when an officer has attached electrodes to the genitals of a woman or a child? Have you been one of those who, out of fear, has pulled the trigger on an automatic rifle, releasing hundreds of bullets in an instant before you knew what had happened, women and children lying dead before you?" And the article, the appeal continues.
Ralph, he states, and this is May 24th, 1966, "I appeal to you to end your participation in this barbarous and criminal war of conquest. Remember, I appeal to you as a human being to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you can do this, you will perform a courageous service to mankind." Then, there are too many people ready to support you for reprisals to take place. It is no use postponing your decision. The moment of trial is always. Now is the appointed time. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. You can contact us at 212-209-2953 or 707-552-9995. Tapes and CDs are available of this program, or look at our internet site www.takingaim.info for our program archive and other information. We'll be with you next week.
That was Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, and as I said, they'll be back with us next week at 5 p.m.